listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of The Abyss by Willem Marx. 70 Hours. As concern rippled outward from Ocean Gate, a senior U.S. Navy official phoned Carl Hartsfield at 10:11 a.m. ET the following morning, alerting him to the incident and urging him to turn on a TV set. "The whole community was just coming alive and everybody was calling everybody," recalls Hartsfield. A former nuclear submarine commander with 30 years military service, he focuses these days on autonomous underwater vehicles at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, or WHOI, whose Alvin submersible explored the Titanic site soon after its discovery in 1985. He'd never before heard of Ocean Gate or the Titan, but he had spent much of his adult life contemplating the possibility of underwater entrapment. "Any time there's a submarine down anywhere in the world, all submariners, all submersible people, everybody that's been at risk under the waves, we all hold our breath." When the Russian submarine Kursk sank to the floor of the Barents Sea in 2000 after one of its torpedoes exploded and tore a gash in its 500-foot hull, up to 23 crew members survived the initial blast. But a freshly elected President Vladimir Putin dithered over accepting outside help, and the sailors eventually succumbed to a lack of oxygen. Hartsfield showed no such hesitation last summer, racing from WHOI's headquarters in Cape Cod up to the U.S. Coast Guard's First District building overlooking Boston Harbor. He helped interpret the information pouring in there, including a call late Monday morning from the U.S. Fleet Forces Command in Norfolk, Virginia, with details of an acoustic anomaly in the Atlantic that had been detected by a secret underwater surveillance system. A similar signal had been picked up when an Argentinian naval submarine called the San Juan had vanished in 2017. It had taken a British firm 12 months to locate its remains, around 30 miles from its last known coordinates, and scattered over a large area of the seafloor by an implosion. Hartsfield and his scientific colleagues at Woods Hole were unable to obtain those classified underlying readings, but they had access to an alternative open-source data provider. More than 4,000 miles south of the Titanic wreck, in a remote stretch of ocean between Africa and South America, a British-controlled volcanic outcrop known as Ascension Island hosts one of only half a dozen acoustic listening posts operated worldwide by a little-known international agency responsible for monitoring nuclear launches. Several years ago, staff from the Preparatory Commission for the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty Organization had stationed three hydrophones above the seafloor north of Ascension in a triangle about a kilometer apart. On the morning of Sunday, June 18th, that array picked up sound waves from a distant underwater event. 10-second snapshots of those readings were then snipped into 30 kilobyte packets of data and fed via satellite to the organization's headquarters in Vienna. From there, they were disseminated in reports to government clients, including the U.S. State Department. They eventually ended up on the screens of Woods Hole experts, who were wary of offering any immediate analysis. "That one data point was not enough to make a decision on, in my opinion," says Hartsfield, "especially when you know that at that time they were racing a 96-hour clock." The Navy had assessed that their own readings of the same underwater event were not definitive, according to a naval official who spoke anonymously to the Wall Street Journal, and absent conclusive evidence of a catastrophic failure of the Titan's pressure hull, another anonymous naval official told the New York Times, it would have been irresponsible not to persevere with the search. Every decision and action was being passed through the First District Chief Rear Admiral John Mauger, with the safety of dozens of men and women engaged in potentially risky aspects of the search, now his responsibility. But Mauger also knew that from the moment a vessel in port received an instruction, it would take more than 30 hours for those orders to take effect on site in the mid-Atlantic. He had a difficult choice to make in no time. There is a delay between when you say something and when you get the feedback from that decision, he explained later. We had that common understanding of what needed to get done and that common intent, and folks continued to move out across the board. The details of the acoustic anomaly were not made public. On that Monday, June 19th, the Bahamas-flagged Deep Energy, owned by UK and Houston-based Technip FMC, was 9 days into a slow chug from Norway to a new project near Mobile, Alabama. Its capabilities include two onboard ROVs that can help oil and gas companies lay 16-inch steel pipes up to 3,000 meters underwater. Captain Ross McLeod heard about some aircraft chatter on the long-range search and rescue radio signal, VHF Channel 16. Raised in the remote Outer Hebrides Islands off Scotland's northwest coast, McLeod had been at sea since high school, the past 10 years as a skipper. When his operations manager in Texas called to discuss the Titan, he had already planned how his vessel could be put to use. I knew that we had sufficient wire rope on board with winches, which would be able to reach the bottom, he remembers. Immediately I understood that was going to be a useful tool, possibly a method of recovering the vehicle, the sub, if we happened to find it. Within minutes of getting the green light, McLeod had turned the Deep Energy around and was hurtling toward the Titanic faster than its published top speed. To be honest, my adrenaline starts pumping by this point, recalls McLeod in his soft Scottish brogue. I truly believed that we were a vessel, the best hope, I thought, for those souls at that time. Cassano, still at JFK, had ordered an Uber to his brother's house in North Salem, New York, where he'd left his truck, and coordinated with the team of operators. Scattered from Alaska to Texas, he would need to pilot their ROV. Cassano tried to rest there briefly, but sleep made little sense given the circumstances, and he gunned his truck north through the dawn, stopping frequently to join conference calls with Ocean Gate's Griffith, Mauger, and other salvage experts from the U.S. Navy. Pelagic is headquartered inside an old truck maintenance depot in the leafy and clapboard-friendly village of East Aurora, New York. Thunder rolled overhead last summer when I visited the space, filled with a hulking yellow ROV, two strong aluminum grabbing hands at the front, and a panoply of cameras affixed around its exterior. Like so many submersibles, it's named for a figure from mythology, the charming, cunning, can-do Greek king Odysseus. In a typical year, Pelagic operators spend a third of their time at sea, working for half a dozen organizations, including Cassano's former employer, NOAA, whose projects they've supported through the mapping, surveying, and sampling of deep-sea coral in the Gulf of Mexico and South Atlantic. But last June, through sheer luck, Odysseus was available and ready for this unexpected deployment. By late afternoon Monday, Cassano himself had made it to Pelagic's facility, where he found members of a nearby trucking firm, a clutch of colleagues, and even some neighbors helping to load Odysseus onto trucks for its first-ever rescue dive. Soon enough, four semis roared west to Buffalo Niagara International in upstate New York, where authorities cleared them straight onto the tarmac. While they waited to be loaded, Cassano began coordinating with the ship that had been hired in St. John's, called the Horizon Arctic, to ensure its deck would be ready and its navigation system and power supply would be compatible. on board the Polar Prince, Griffith had separately reached out to a former OceanGate employee now working for Woods Hole, who had in turn called principal submersible engineer Andy Bowen, who started plugging the names of suitably equipped scientific research vessels into a global map that tracks sea traffic data. It was really kind of a trip around the horn to figure out who we might be able to call into action to help, Bowen recalled, similar in some ways to another frantic logistical scramble in the frightening era of Dr. Strangelove. Back in 1966, Woods Hole's Alvin Sub had been suddenly called up to help end an extraordinary diplomatic furor, provoked when an American aircraft accidentally dropped an H-bomb off the coast of Spain. The circumstances of the accident had clearly undermined assurances made by U.S. forces that they were not engaged in nuclear logistics on any of the bases they'd leased from Madrid. After 80 days of underwater searching and one failed winch effort, the bomb was eventually recovered without casualties. As Bowen worked through his mental shortlist of the dozen or so submersibles worldwide that he knew could safely dive to the Titanic's depth, the nearest he could find was on board Atalante, a French ship named for the only mythical Greek heroine allowed to join the all-male Argonauts. Bowen knew the vessel usually carried an ROV called Victor 6000, built to descend to 6,000 meters, and so reached out to a longtime friend at EFREME, the French government agency that oversees the country's oceanographic efforts. It turned out that the Atalante was helping with a geophysical survey in the Azores. But after a flurry of communications between Cape Cod, Boston, Paris, and Brest in northwest France, the Atalante's captain quickly charted a new course and put the hammer down, in Bowen's words, racing for more than 48 hours northwest toward the Polar Prince in a bid to save one of its own. Paul-Henri Nargiolet, the Titan's missing co-pilot, had once overseen Ephraim's subsea operations, descending to the Titanic wreck several times in the agency's older submersible, Nautile. Diving the far newer Victor 6000 to any depth would be difficult, though, since the 10-man specialist team that usually operated it was not aboard the Atalante. But at their base in France, they frantically started packing for a mid-ocean rendezvous. 60 hours. That Monday evening at Joint Base McGuire-Dix Lakehurst in New Jersey, Captain Matthew Hahn got a fresh set of orders. There'd be no trip to Germany to pick up service members' household items. Instead, he'd be making a quick swing through Dover Air Force Base to Delaware in his C-17 Globemaster III to pick up some pallets and an extended forklift system used on military cargo known as a K-loader. Then, on to Buffalo, where he would collect heavy but delicate cargo that had never been airlifted. The Odysseus ROV would be difficult to tie down securely without damaging it, but any shift in weight during takeoff could also dangerously upset the aircraft's trim over a heavily populated area. None of it was normal, and none of it was what we'd ever seen before, the senior loadmaster, Technical Sergeant Eric McKinley, recalled. But he and his colleagues had already grasped that Odysseus might be the Titan's best hope. We had to make this mission work. Many hours later, as Hahn descended over the rugged Atlantic coastline into St. John's, the 27-year-old from Virginia concluded it was the worst landing in his 2 years of flying missions. A 20-knot right-to-left crosswind whipped across the slick and slippery asphalt, the visibility so poor that the ground only flashed into vision with 200 feet left, the lowest altitude at which his instruments would safely permit him to land manually. I actually saw the lights leading up to the runway first before I saw the runway, he says. In the cockpit of the C-17 behind him one of three called upon to help transport the Odysseus and its accompanying equipment, Ed Cassano grabbed the armrest as the pilots roared in for the turbulent touchdown. The already exhausted New Jersey crew members crashed at a nearby hotel, not realizing their import in the high-profile rescue, until locals approached them the next day at Starbucks and then a grocery store to thank them. 36 hours. The St. John's Airport sits on a plain just north of town, with little room for the three vast U.S. military aircraft that had been forced to parallel park there. On Pier 12, the Horizon Arctic's tracked cranes hoisted 10 and 20-foot containers onto the deck, Pelagic's engineers deciding their precise positioning, typically a week-long task, in just minutes. A team of eight welders had worked through the night to ensure that the grillage, a steel base to which the Odysseus's winch would be attached, was secure. At 8:30 p.m. local time, their blowtorches were still blazing as the last truck arrived from the airport. Cassano had told authorities it might take more than 24 hours to install the equipment, but they turned it around in eight, and after a brief safety inspection, the Horizon Arctic was cleared for departure. The vessel, owned by the same Newfoundland firm as the Polar Prince, had worked with OceanGate over the previous two seasons. Many of those on board, including the captain, knew Stockton Rush personally. 29 hours. The Horizon Arctic powered through the narrow entrance of St. John's Harbor by 4 a.m. Wednesday, past abandoned British and French cannon post, with heavily forested hillsides to the starboard and a craggy wind-swept outcrop called Signal Hill on its port side. More than 111 years had elapsed since a message had reached the hill's telegram station announcing that the Titanic had struck an iceberg. Learning this, Cassano felt his neck prickle. Adam Myers, the ship's captain, instructed his chief engineer to push the engine to its limits, cresting at more than 17 knots to reduce the 400-mile journey to the southern edge of the Atlantic's Grand Banks by an hour or more. Every freaking minute was counting, Cassano recalls, as the Pelagic team began prepping for their final task, the rescue itself. The plan they had formulated with those on other vessels near the Polar Prince was relatively simple, based on the tools they had available. Encased in the polymer rope of the Odysseus's miles-long umbilical cord were copper wires that power the vehicle below the surface, as well as fiber optic cables that feed imagery from the 8K cameras. It wasn't built as a dedicated hoisting line. But the Pelagic team was confident it could lift 20,000 to 30,000 pounds of extra weight from the seafloor. OceanGate Scott Griffith, by then transferred from the Polar Prince to the Deep Energy, which was already on site, had confirmed the Titan weighed around 23,000 pounds. Once the Titan was located and before ascending, Odysseus would maneuver a vast hook, known as a Crosby, and attach it to a shackle point on the Titan's hull, as well as two beacons in case the prone sub somehow slipped back into the abyss and required relocating. Given the weights involved, the Deep Energy's ROVs would also concurrently dive to their maximum depth above the Odysseus, waiting to attach the Titan to the pipe-laying vessel's far more robust rope and powerful winch, to help ease the burden for the remaining 2,700-meter lift. "We're going down. We'll grab them. We'll come up. We'll meet the other vehicle," Cassano explained. "It'll go get the lift line. Bang. We'll lift them. We're out." 4 hours. After a full 24 hours of powering through the Atlantic swell, they reached the site and began coordinating with the Deep Energy, believing those on board the Titan might have only hours remaining. "I'm doing the math in my head," Cassano recalls. "I know that when we arrive on site, we probably have I believe, plus or minus four. Dozens of decisions, hundreds if not thousands of people, exponentially more phone calls and emails had kept hope alive. But there was now almost no margin for error remaining once the team factored in the time needed for the long descent, actually finding the Titan and then the final leg up to the surface. That time just goes so quickly. It was horrible. Every time I looked at the clock, another hour had passed, said Deep Energy Captain Ross McLeod, waking after just 2 hours of sleep. Nevertheless, it was a moment of optimism, as he described it, with his engineers planning how they might reprogram their winch system to make that final hoist even faster, before dragging the Titan up on deck and drilling a hole through its hull to provide oxygen to those inside as fast as possible. Just before 2 a.m. local time, the Canadian Coast Guard's Anne Harvey joined the cluster of vessels after its own race from St. John's with a submersible crew that normally worked on the French Efreme vessel, the Atlante. A choppy sea and dark fog made it difficult to ferry the 10 French ROV operators and their equipment several hundred feet across to the Atlante. Each of them raced up their ship's ladder like a scalded cat, according to the Anne Harvey's captain, to begin preparing their vehicle to dive as well. The dozen-strong flotilla began taking instruction on their positioning from the horizon Arctic at that point. Cassano remembers the Deep Energy's McLeod handing over responsibility ahead of their last gasp effort with the words, "This is your show." Skipper Adam Myers was nearby on the Horizon Arctic's bridge. He and Cassano locked in as they worked closely to initiate the delicate process of launching an ROV off a vessel that was rolling and pitching in 12-knot winds, its engines powering multiple vast propellers to maintain a precise position, yard by yard at times, for a secure start to the dive. 3 hours. Following several final checks, the Odysseus was lowered off the back and into the water to begin its faster-than-usual plunge just south of the Titan's last known position, to avoid the possibility of actually coming down on top of the missing sub. Inside the white shipping container turned control room perched on the Horizon Arctic's rear deck, the Pelagic team used several keyboards and controllers to guide the Odysseus, its array of cameras broadcasting images of the darkness up to a wall of screens. Back in Boston, Mauger and the dozens of First District officers held their breath, hoping for the best possible outcome. With the dive underway, Coast Guard commanders requested that ship-to-ship communications protocols change, given the presence of family members on board the nearby Polar Prince. If there were signs of life, Pelagic could immediately broadcast the news on an open channel to get the needed assets into position. But absent that, they must be more circumspect. "If you find something, it does not go over the radio," Cassano was told. Odysseus dropped through a powerful midwater current. Then, just above the seafloor, at a depth of 3,831 meters, came a major setback. Its thrusters unexpectedly failed. After several precious minutes spent trying to restart them, the Pelagic team on the surface began the painful process of winching Odysseus back to the surface, and the Horizon Arctic moved backward away from the last known location. Aware his window of viability was near to closing, a crushed Cassano raced back to the bridge and over VHF Channel 74, open to the whole flotilla, relayed this setback to the bridge of the Deep Energy, the de facto coordinating vessel. "Guys, we're out. We've got an issue. We're going to pull up, but let's get the French in. Let's get them to go ahead of us." The team from Atlante was only several hundred yards away and had already started to dive their backup ROV, Victor 6000, taking care not to tangle the umbilicals that connected the two submersibles to their controllers up top. Horizon Arctic and Atalante shifted spots precisely using their dynamic positioning, a complex pas de deux that would allow this potentially life-saving baton to be passed. As Victor 6000 continued its long descent just to the west, Odysseus roared back to life after a remote reset. "We're back in the game," shouted Cassano to Deep Energy, immediately instructing his teammates to redive the final few hundred meters. Minutes later, back on the Horizon Arctic's bridge, with a radio set in either hand, Cassano was startled out of his concentration by the ship's second mate calling his name over and over. They needed him back on the deck. His team had found something. Cassano careened once more down 7 flights of stairs, taking care not to hit his head on several low beams. He clasped the door to the small space where the ROV's pilots, navigator, and comms operator quietly turned to look at him. Beside him on a leather-cushioned bench was Kyle Bingham, OceanGate's mission director, with Brian Blake, the Navy's lead for subsea salvage operations, not far away. Cassano scanned the small sea of faces for a hint of what had happened, then on several screens in front of him saw an image from the camera on Odysseus's main bow. Through the thick, bulbous lens, mounted beneath a yellow fiberglass roof, and between the dark aluminum arms, was unmistakably a piece of man-made modern debris. It was one of 5 large pieces of the Titan, including the tail cone and 2 shattered ends of the pressure hull, resting on the seafloor about 1/3 of a mile from the Titanic's bow. The window of viability had closed, if it had ever been open. Hours later, the U.S. Coast Guard confirmed the news to a waiting world. Death and the Mask. In Hollywood in 1977, punk rock was exploding, and a small band of scene makers were flourishing in a dingy basement club. Little did they know, a pair of serial killers would soon claim one of their own, by Joe Pompeo. Opening illustration, a cast of dozens. Hollywood punk rock's class of 77 included a host of figures who shaped the coming decades of culture. Jane King sat down at the bus stop on Franklin Avenue and stretched out her legs, crossing them at the ankles as she inhaled the nighttime air. Class had ended, and King was waiting to board an 89 for the roughly 4.5-mile ride home. Across the way, the old Chateau Elysee loomed over her, a palatial 7 stories of Norman Revival architecture. The building had begun its journey in November 1924, when the filmmaker Thomas Ince was stricken with chest pains during a party on William Randolph Hearst's yacht. Days later, Ince died of heart failure, leaving behind $1.6 million for his widow, the actor Eleanor Kershaw, who used a portion of her inheritance to construct the Chateau Elysee. Gossip mongers whispered that she'd financed the chateau with hush money from Hearst, rumored to have murdered her husband. But that's another story. Over the next 2 decades, before it was sold and converted into an upscale retirement community that fell into disrepair, the chateau served as a luxury hotel and apartment complex for Hollywood stars. Now revitalized amid the towering palms, it belonged to the Church of Scientology. The church had purchased the property 4 years earlier and turned it into Scientology's inaugural celebrity center, also known as the Manor Hotel, where a local theater company hosted an acting class in the basement. King had enrolled in the course, which is what brought her to the Manor on the pleasant Los Angeles evening of Wednesday, November 9th, 1977. Like so many young women in Hollywood, King wanted to be an actor, and she looked the part too. Tall and slender, with shimmering blonde hair that fell to her shoulders, she had brown eyes, thin lips, and a face that turned heads. She'd arrived at class that Wednesday in a fitted sweater and tight jeans, folded into cuffs above a shiny silver heels, which matched the small purse she carried. After class, around 11 p.m., a friend had asked King if she needed a lift back to her apartment in West Hollywood. And what would turn out to be the most fateful decision of her 28-year-old life, King had declined the offer, saying she would take the bus instead. And so there she sat on the corner of Franklin and Bronson, waiting for the 89 in front of a Mayfair supermarket. Alone, but not for long. 3 days later, on the morning of Saturday, November 12th, King's roommate called the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department to let the authorities know she had never returned home. A sheriff's deputy, after making inquiries with the church, King's mother, and Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, began to prepare a missing persons report. 20 minutes before noon, he typed out the following words, assigned Homicide Bureau. That night, about a mile west of the chateau, a cavernous basement boomed with a furious din of punk rock, which had taken London by storm, torn through downtown Manhattan, and was now spreading like wildfire in Los Angeles. Here, in the seedy heart of the city, just off Hollywood Boulevard, a community of misfits had begun congregating in an underground, figuratively and literally, venue called The Mask. Headlining the evening's 4-act bill was a new band called X, which would become one of the most influential and longest-running punk bands of all time. Tonight was their first time playing The Mask, Hollywood's answer to CBGB. Response from the front was unanimous, one attendee raved. X is a good way to go. To get to The Mask from Hollywood Boulevard, you had to walk down North Cherokee and hang a right into an alleyway where there was no obvious indication that you had arrived, as the Los Angeles rock As the Los Angeles Times rock journalist Christine McKenna put it back then, at the hottest punk nightclub in town. In fact, the only punk nightclub at the time. Through a prison-like doorway, concrete stairs descended into the underworld of a five-story Art Deco building, which in the 1930s housed Hollywood's newly minted labor unions. A second stairwell, the Stairway to Nowhere, located at the other end of the 10,000-square-foot space, dead-ended at the floor of the Pussycat Theater, where Deep Throat earned as much as $11,000 a week. On a typical night, the mask reeked of sweat, beer, and cigarette smoke, illuminated by dim lights hanging from a ceiling dotted with splotches of dried glue. The tiles were long gone. Graffiti covered the walls, displaying catchphrases and band names. "The whiskey and starwood may showcase the big punk acts," wrote McKenna, "but the mask is the only spot with authentic underground ambiance." Sartorially, the mask was a bit of a hodgepodge, with a heavy dose of retro thrift store finds. The eclectic L.A. punk style that would take hold over the next few years was beginning to rear its head. Slim jeans, skinny neckties, thin-striped T-shirts, snug greaser jackets and blazers, torn fishnets, heavy eyeliner, sunglasses after dark, leopard print, the occasional black trash bag fashioned into a dress. "We knew something really special was going on," recalls Belinda Carlisle of the Go-Go's. "You could feel it in the air." Bands that emerged at the mask became the stuff of legend. Carlisle and her fellow Go-Go's were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2021. Celebrated for their well-crafted songs that formed a bridge between the brash urgency of L.A. punk and the dark melodies of new wave pop. That same year, the Screamers received a belated New York Times profile, pegged to the first and only official release after more than four decades of their avant-garde synth punk. The Germs, whose guitarist Pat Smear broke into the mainstream as a member of Nirvana and the Foo Fighters, were immortalized in Roger Grossman's 2007 biopic, What We Do Is Secret, starring Shane West as doomed singer Darby Crash and Bijou Phillips as celebrated bassist Lorna Doom. Some habitués of the mask found their own success in film and TV. Penelope Spheeris directed box office hits like Wayne's World and The Little Rascals after chronicling the early days of L.A. punk in her landmark 1981 documentary, The Decline of Western Civilization. Screamers drummer K.K. Barrett became an Academy Award-nominated production designer, known for his work with Spike Jonze and Sofia Coppola. Kira Russler, who went on to play bass in Black Flag, made her name as an Emmy Award-winning dialogue editor with credits on The Twilight Saga and Game of Thrones. Fear frontman Lee Ving has an IMDb page that includes appearances in Flashdance, Clue, as the menacing Mr. Body, and an infamous 1981 episode of Saturday Night Live, during which Fear, thanks to a bit of string pulling by John Belushi, wreaked havoc as the evening's musical guest. The mask unlikely impresario was Brendan Mullen, a skinny Scottish expat who lived at the bottom of the main staircase in a room that doubled as his office. In the coming years, Mullen would give the Red Hot Chili Peppers their first gig, book shows for a pre-fame Guns N' Roses, and help launch the Viper Room with Johnny Depp. For now, at 28, he was simply an affable, music-loving UK transplant who'd stumbled into a career promoting shows. As Mullen wrote in 2007, no big plans to open up a punk palace, no entrepreneurial impulse inspired me to start a business. Only dumb luck compelled me. A former newspaper reporter and a drummer, Mullen had come upon the basement by chance in the spring of 1977, while looking for somewhere to jam without having to worry about neighbors calling the cops. He struck a deal for an $850 monthly lease, cleaned the place up, partitioned off some rooms, and advertised it as a spot for bands to rent rehearsal space. We were literally dead center in the bowels of Hollywood, Mullen later recalled. I agreed to take it as is, thrashed to hell, and got a free month's rent to clear out 15 years of debris. Almost in the blink of an eye, Mullen's humble rehearsal studio transformed into an all-hours playground for the first generation of L.A.'s punk rock and new wave cognoscenti. It was more of a clubhouse than a club or a venue per se, says Marina Mulfreidel, better known as Marina Del Rey, whose band Backstage Pass was among the first to shack up in one of the Mask practice rooms. Mulfreidel's salary as an editor at Teen Magazine enabled her to co-sign the lease when Mullen ran into trouble with the landlord. We were all in it together. Another early visitor was the performance artist and Andy Warhol star Bibi Hansen, who frequented the Mask with her father, the Fluxus artist Al Hansen. Bibi could often be found taking photographs of the Controllers, another early Mask band, during their rehearsals. She would sometimes bring along her 7-year-old son, a future Grammy Award-winning musician named Beck. I'm from New York, so I'm used to alternative spaces and dark places, she says, but for L.A., it was pretty raw. In late August, with the addition of a stage that couldn't have been more than a foot high, Mullen started booking shows. Through the end of summer and into the fall, hundreds of young punk fans and other miscellaneous oddballs packed the Mask to see bands like the Dickies and the Zeros, the Avengers and the Bags, the Weirdos and the Eyes and the Alley Cats. No two bands born or bred at the Mask were alike, the L.A. Times' McKenna later recalled, also observing the mix of people was incredibly diverse. Rich kids, poor kids, drug addicts, alcoholic art students. On the surface, nobody had much in common, yet all were unmistakably members of the same tribe. In the popular imagination, late 70s L.A. was a sun-kissed Xanadu of disco and yacht rock. The Mask nurtured a dark and irreverent alternative, creating a space where an influential subculture could thrive. It was a heady atmosphere of vice, debauchery, art, rebellion, and the requisite dash of danger. To a punk rocker, recalls Kid Congo Powers, who went from Mask regular to guitarist for the Cramps, the Gun Club, and Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, few things were more alluring than danger. Danger, indeed, was closing in. An era had dawned that would become known as the Golden Age of Serial Killers, and Los Angeles was on its way to earning the unfortunate designation of Serial Killer Capital of America. The latest serial killings were now unfolding in the hillsides around Hollywood, where the corpses of young women had been turning up with ligature marks around the necks, victims of an anonymous perpetrator dubbed the Hillside Strangler. The 7th identification of a strangler victim came on the evening of Wednesday, November 23rd, as the Mask filled up for a show headlined by The Germs. Authorities were able to get an ID on the body using fingerprints and dental charts. As it turned out, she was a familiar face at the Mask, a blonde beauty who had celebrated her 28th birthday just a month earlier. She lived in an apartment at 8530 Holloway Drive, West Hollywood, and she'd been reported missing by her roommate on November 12th, after failing to return home from an acting class at the Scientology Center on Franklin Avenue. Her name was Jane King. King's body was discovered on the outskirts of Griffith Park, beside an off-ramp of the Golden State Freeway. A cowboy boot-wearing homicide detective named Dudley Varney arrived to inspect the crime scene, determining the body had been thrown or tossed from the area of the roadway. Varney had been appointed to oversee the field investigations of the Cross-Agency Hillside Strangler Task Force, which set out to probe the killings. Yolanda Washington, a 19-year-old sex worker, mother of a 2-year-old daughter, and the sole black woman on a growing list of victims, had been found near Griffith Park on October 16th. the body of Judith Miller, a 15-year-old runaway and former Hollywood High School student, turned up on November 1st in a residential neighborhood in La Crescenta. 21-year-old Lissa Kasten, a waitress from North Hollywood and member of an all-female dance troupe called the L.A. Knockers, was found on a highway embankment near the Chevy Chase Country Club in Glendale on November 6th. Christina Weckler, a 20-year-old honors student at Pasadena's Art Center College of Design, was found dead in Highland Park by a group of hikers on November 20th. Later that same day came the discovery of Dolores Cepeda and Sonia Johnson, just 12 and 14 years old, last seen at the Eagle Rock Plaza Shopping Center. A 9-year-old boy hunting for treasure in a trash heap near Dodger Stadium happened upon their remains. And then there was King, identified in newspaper reports as a beautiful, aspiring actor and model, sometimes known to accept hitchhiking rides in the Hollywood area. She was trying to break into famous Hollywood, the roommate who had reported King missing on November 12th told the L.A. Times. She was always on the go, running around, always out someplace. She was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. The director of Scientology's Celebrity Center International told the Times King had studied there. She was currently working as a model and was into music, he said. She had a definite interest in acting and had hoped to pursue that line. Overall, he sensed that King was trying to find herself. Born in Arizona on October 20th, 1949, King grew up in Arcadia, California, just outside L.A.'s northeast city limits. She was quiet and shy, says Bill Pauly, a childhood classmate. Cecilia Joder befriended King at Arcadia High School, where they were members of the class of 1967, one year behind Stevie Nicks. We sat next to each other in arts and crafts, and we just had a ball, says Joder. She was a run-of-the-mill girl like me. I didn't expect her to be running around Hollywood. When I heard that she'd been killed, I was shocked. A brief inscription in one of Joder's high school yearbooks was the only trace of King's voice that I could find. Cecilia, she wrote, it was fun this year in psychology and last year in art crafts. Be happy. Love, Jane King. King's younger sister, Judy King, told me about their childhood being raised by a single working mother, Abra King, in Arcadia, where the family lived with Abra's parents. There were vacations at the national parks and at the beaches near San Diego. Occasionally, letters and gifts arrived from the girl's absent father, a ranch hand in New Mexico. After high school, Jane found jobs as a candy striper and a massage therapist. She discovered Scientology, drawn to its promise, as Judy recalls, of helping practitioners remove hindrances that might keep you from being your best self. And she gave birth to a daughter in 1968, fathered by a young man Jane had met while celebrating Mardi Gras in New Orleans. Jane, not yet 20, decided that an adoption was in the baby's best interest. Before saying goodbye, she settled on the name she would have given her, Goldberry, in homage to a character from the works of J.R.R. Tolkien. After Judy graduated high school 2 years behind Jane, she moved to Oregon with a man who lured her into what she described as a cult-like community. Sometime in 1973 or 1974, Jane visited Judy and tried to bring her back home. It was the last time that Judy, who eventually did break away from her communal family, saw or spoke to her sister. She realized I was being deceived, Judy says. She was trying to rescue me. Jane's love of rock and roll, especially the Rolling Stones, blossomed in her teenage years. So it made sense later when she began dating a fellow Stones enthusiast named Rick Wilder, who would be described in the L.A. Times as a Mick Jagger Johnny Rotten clone created by some mad punk scientist. Next photo, screen test. Jane King had Hollywood dreams that she was beginning to realize. Her sister points to this shot from the opening montage of 1977's Looking for Mr. Goodbar. Wilder can't recall exactly when he met King, but it had to have been sometime in the mid-1970s. Back then, Wilder was the singer of the Berlin Bratz, once dubbed L.A.'s first homegrown glam rock band. His parents were the opera singers Giovanni Milo and Margherita Girosi. One of his two sisters, April Milo, became a luminary of the Metropolitan Opera. The other, Grace Milo, became a singer-songwriter. They had a peripatetic childhood, traveling around as their parents toured small opera houses and concert halls in Italy and the U.S. When a heart condition forced Giovanni to give up his singing career, the family settled in Los Angeles, where Wilder attended Hollywood High School, Fairfax High School, and the now-defunct Hollywood Professional School, whose alumni include John Drew Barrymore, Judy Garland, Melanie Griffith, Val Kilmer, Mickey Rooney, and Natalie Wood. King entered Wilder's orbit when she started dating his childhood friend and bandmate Matt Campbell. As King and Campbell's relationship went south, King and Wilder hit it off. "He would have fights with her," Wilder recalls. "After one of those fights, we ended up in a closet making love." King showed Wilder her headshots. Wilder offered to give King singing lessons. They became an item, on and off, and shared an apartment for a period of time, according to Wilder, who still has photos of his former sweetheart. "I used to have one of her holding my Hamlet skull," he says, "which she thought was maybe a good picture." King frequented Berlin Bratz performances. In the summer of 1977, as Wilder was falling under the spell of punk rock and Mullen was getting his new rehearsal space off the ground, the Bratz rented a room, becoming one of the earliest bands to inhabit the basement, alongside Backstage Pass, the Controllers, and the Skulls, some of whose members went on to form Wall of Voodoo, which scored an early MTV hit with the 1982 single Mexican Radio. King was a regular at the Bratz practices, hanging around and sipping Rainier Ale through a straw. "She was a sweet-natured, goofily naive Stevie Nicks fan," Mullen would later recall, "who danced around her apartment to Rhiannon rather than the Sex Pistols or Ramones." King worked in a clothing shop on Sunset Boulevard while pursuing her Hollywood aspirations. Her sister told me she appeared briefly as part of a photographic montage in the opening credits of Richard Brooks' Looking for Mr. Goodbar, starring Diane Keaton and Richard Gere, a 1977 crime drama that would garner 2 Oscar nominations. The film, inspired by the 1973 murder of a New York City schoolteacher, premiered just weeks before King's disappearance. "She wanted to be famous," says Wilder. To some of the masked, more bedraggled patrons, King seemed out of their league. "She looked a little out of place," says Johnny Stingray, guitarist for the Controllers. "I was a little too shy to say anything to her." Skulls frontman Stephen Fortuna, also known as Billy Bones, remembers King as a more conventionally fashionable figure than the rest of the mask crowd. "She always had style," he says, "just a really nice person." Liz Winchell first encountered King at Wilder's Hollywood Party Pad on the corner of Franklin and Whitley in a 1920s building designed by the same architects responsible for the Beverly Wilshire Hotel. "I remember the day I met her," says Winchell, whose grandfather was the legendary gossip columnist Walter Winchell. "We were playing the Stones, and that's what she and I first started talking about. We both loved the music. She was not a typical punk girl at all. She was very beautiful and put together in a way that we were not. She was on a different level." Winchell and King would go shopping together on Hollywood Boulevard and run around looking to score Quaaludes. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.